This is Berg from Voices in Japan. If you're thinking about learning Japanese, you should check out marumori.io. It's an all-in-one resource for learning grammar, kanji, vocabulary, etc. And they have reading exercises, memory flashcards, their own dictionary, mini games, and super detailed grammar lessons. And the best part is, they have a free trial. They also often have sales that offer great discounts when you sign up. Please use our Marumori affiliate link in this episode description, as that will support our podcast.
Yeah, I don't know if you've been following the news recently in
Japan. The super big news, especially Hokkaido.
I'm not quite sure what big news you're speaking of here.
Baseball news.
Okay, keep
huge
going.
Celebrity.
You a fan? Baseball fan?
No? Shohei Ohtani news. Okay. Interpreter. You haven't heard any of these?
Yeah, I did hear about that.
Yeah. Possibly. Interpreter what? Has stolen or maybe not stolen $4.5 million from Ohtani. For gambling purposes, and last time we recorded, it was kind of just coming out as news. But yeah, a lot of people are saying, is he just covering for Ohtani? Because, you know, such an innocent guy, but maybe he was actually placing the bets. But the most recent news that I was going to tell Ben about was that it's just come out that this interpreter, who is a bit of a celebrity himself in Japan, his whole like resume, he basically lied about, like, the university they went to in the US, UC Riverside, has come out and said they don't have any records of him, being a student there. Let's see, some of the former clubs that he worked at in the US, baseball teams and stuff, said that he wasn't actually an interpreter on the team, or the circumstances that he was working on the team were not how he presented them on his resume. So then, he basically joined up with Ohtani-sense, the Fighters. So from the point he was working with him at the Fighters, everything is legitimate, but they're now finding out everything before that was faked. And they're kind of saying, like, didn't the Fighters vet this guy before all this happened? But so you've heard nothing about this, or you've heard a little bit? Or?
Yeah, I have heard about it. We were actually talking about his interpreter the other day for some reason. My partner does a lot of seminars, online seminars with foreigners that come over and do, you know, coaching stuff. And so anyways, we were talking about interpreters, and just out of curiosity, we decided to find out how much his interpreter makes. He makes really good money.
Yeah, he gets paid, right?
So it surprises me that he would have to steal any money at all.
Yeah, what was it? Money. Like between 300 and 500,000 US or something per year he was making?
Was that his salary?
Well, with the Dodgers, the pro baseball team.
Yeah. I think when he was here for Flyers, it was like 80 grand a year, which is still a lot.
Yeah. It's a decent wage.
For not really doing too much, right? Just get to hang out with Ohtani and live his lifestyle, but not play baseball.
Yeah. Follows him everywhere.
Yeah. Well, yeah, doing everything. Well, that's the thing. Like some people are saying, I mean, there's still a lot of people who suspect Ohtani was the one placing the bets and this is the fall guy. I don't buy into that because I still believe in the pure angel boy Ohtani image and stuff.
I don't know, man.
But I don't know. Some people are saying because his interpreter was older and he met him when he was 19, he very much was reliant on him. And there was also a bit of the like senior, junior aspect of the relationship, so he was just always kind of following what he was being told to do. But Ben is especially one of the kind of skeptical.
I'm suspicious.
He thinks Ohtani is an AI robot.
Well, this is like the kind of the only human thing that's come out since he's been a professional, right? This kind of slip up,
right?
But I don't know. I got a feeling that he's the gambler, because it's like, how does this guy have access to his bank accounts? Like, you're not just gonna give him your pin codes and everything and take $4.5 million.
So it's a cover up for Ohtani.
And now they're doing like this character assassination on the interpreter, because, you know, if MLB lose Ohtani and if it comes out that he was gambling, they have to fire him, right? They have to ban him for like life,
right?
I don't know if they have to ban him, but it's going to be very severe punishments. But that's the thing, though. They're so adamant about, they give like all the incoming players lectures about how they can't gamble, apparently, on any sports. And then in baseball, it's like up in every locker room as a reminder that they can't bet on baseball and stuff. So I mean, and most of the bets were placed on non-baseball events, or I don't actually, maybe none of them are placed on baseball. So yeah, it's kind of like, yeah, but how would Ohtani be having the time to study all these other sports placing bets? Unless he's just straight up addicted, which could be possible, you know, had a little bit of the taste. Anyways, so that was the big news. We'll see what happens. By the time this comes out, more will be revealed.
Right.
So,
anyway, we have a special guest on today, Greg. You're from Canada, Quebecan?
I'm from Ontario, actually. I grew up right on the border of Ontario and Quebec.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And you've been in Hokkaido for about 20 years?
20 years, that's right.
20 years, yeah. Originally came to study classical Japanese martial arts. Is that like a bunch of different martial arts?
Yeah, I mean, originally, basically, classical Japanese martial arts, or any martial art that basically was developed, you know, a loose definition before the Meiji Restoration. So what would that be? 1876, if I got the number right.
Hmm.
So anything that was developed before that time is considered a classical martial art. Hmm. And anything after the banning of the swords, right? And the, you know, the, when the samurai class is basically, done away with, anything after that time is considered a modern martial art.
Hmm.
It's a loose definition.
Hmm.
So, you know, yeah, I grew up doing a traditional style of karate, and sort of the karate that I trained in also did Ryukyu Kobudo.
What is that?
Which is Okinawan Kobudo, which it's the study of the weapons. So 6-foot staff, sai, tonfa, nunchaku, nichogama, that sort of stuff. So I've always kind of been interested in weaponry.
Can you use nunchucks?
Yeah.
Because in England, they're illegal.
They're
banned.
Illegal in Canada too.
Yeah. But I remember, like, when I was growing up, one of my buddies, he was like a martial arts fanatic, and he had a pair of nunchucks at home.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we were like 10 years old, but he could use them pretty well, but obviously they're dangerous. But yeah, I've never met anyone else that can use nunchucks. They're quite hard to use, right?
They are hard to use. I mean, it's not and it's kind of a minor weapon in the Okinawan Kobudo syllabus. There's no classical or traditional kata or forms left for the nunchaku. So, I mean, I don't think they'd be all that effective against a sword or a 6-foot staff. So I think that's probably part of the reason. Somebody, you know, wielding a knife or something like that, I think I'd feel pretty confident.
Also, you'd probably end up like knocking yourself out anyway if you try to use them.
They can be dangerous. But yeah, as a matter of fact, you know, the very first publication ever on the nunchaku was published by the style of karate that I do. I think it was a pamphlet that was published in 1969, I think. And believe it or not, Bruce Lee actually studied that pamphlet and learned a lot of the basics from that booklet. So it's quite interesting.
And he must be the one who kind of popularized
it. Yeah. I mean, so anyways, I've always loved the weapons. So that kind of drew me to... Because Kobudo means old martial art.
Kobudo. Oh,
right?
Okay, yeah.
So, you know, it kind of got me interested in the classical Japanese martial arts. So, which is, you know, sword.
Kendo, for example.
Well, Kendo's a modern martial art.
Oh, really?
Right? Kendo's quite modern. It's actually based on the style of swordsmanship I study. I study a style called Onoha Itoryu Kenjutsu. And that's kind of the mother art of all the Itoryu schools. And so Kendo came from that, you know, hundreds of years later. So it's, you know, all the modern martial arts, they've basically become martial sports, right? But they're all based on very old systems of warfare, basically, right? Classical feudal warfare.
So you were doing this in Canada before you came?
I did karate and the Okinawan Kobudo in Canada before I came here. And I joined an Aikido dojo in Canada. And that also, I felt it was, I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but I felt it was quite ineffective and more of a
I'm a little bit of the same opinion.
I was about to say, what do you think? Is it effective or not?
Preaching of the choir here. But that led me to think about, well, where did it come from? And it came from a much older art called Aiki Jujutsu, Daitoryu Aiki Jujutsu. Mm. And the headquarters for that style was in Abashiri for, you know, close to 100 years. So Hokkaido's kind of a mecca for Daitoryu, the predecessor of modern Aikido, basically.
Mm.
So I study that on Saturday nights, and I do Onoha, the Kenjutsu, on Mondays. And Monday nights, you know, my sensei does a lot of other things as well. So we do Jodo as well. And the Jodo art, for those that don't know what a Jo is, it's a 4-foot staff.
Okay.
And so, So Shinto Musoryu Jodo was developed by the only guy who beat Musashi in a duel.
Oh, really? Wait, so somebody, there's actual record of him losing?
One guy.
Okay.
And he beat him with a stick.
Oh.
But Burke's Japanese name is actually
Musashi.
Is it really?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. But wait, so isn't he famous, though, for having never lost a duel? But you're saying so there is one that he lost.
There is one duel he lost. He lost it. They actually dueled twice. Okay. And once Musashi won, and then the other one, Gonosuke, Muso Gonosuke was the guy's name. He actually beat Musashi, and they became friends, and they went on a little bit of a tour around Japan together.
Wow.
Imagine bumping into those two guys on the road.
Exactly.
Wow. Well,
and he used, when he beat him, he used the Jo.
With the Jo, a 4-foot staff. And so this Shinto Musoryu, it's a comprehensive classical martial arts style. So it not only encompasses a 4-foot staff, but it also has jitte, which is a truncheon. So it looks like a small iron bar with a little hook.
Okay.
Right. And the Edo period police used to use it as kind of like a baton type of thing. They also there's a sword syllabus. There's a sword component to the style. There's also a, kusarigama. So chain and sickle.
You've used one of those?
I've got a practice one. I actually bought one this year. You can't buy them online. You can't get them. You have to have someone make them for you. You just can't find them, right?
They're so not you had real. Somebody make?
Yeah, so there's a guy from a dojo in Tokyo made a bunch for us. So we use that one. There's a bunch of the short staff, like almost like a walking stick component. Like, so it's a complete bujutsu system, basically. It's cool. So they do that as well. So we learn that on Monday. So much stuff to learn. It's hard to absorb it all, really, but I'm working on it.
Yeah. So you have all these weapons at home as well, like an armory, just in case someone breaks in.
There's quite a collection at home.
Don't mess with Greg.
Yeah, if somebody breaks into your house, they're probably going to walk right back out and see what's going on.
There's quite a collection. And, you know, there's always something new coming into the house, it seems.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And also you've been a rafting guide for 12 years before coming to Hokkaido. I'm guessing in Canada.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So basically, I started rafting. So I grew up in a town about a half an hour drive from the rafting operation on the Ottawa River.
Okay.
And so the Ottawa River is in North America, it boasts the largest commercially run rapid in North America.
Oh, wow.
And it's called Coliseum. And in high water, it's got three waves. The first wave's called the Kahuna. The second wave's called Mikey because it eats everything.
And then Mikey, like,
right from the Life cereal commercial. And the third wave is called Holy Shit, It's Big Today. And each and every one of those waves can flip a 22-foot raft completely end over end.
Oh, man.
It's a monstrous rapid. Yeah. So I grew up there. That's where I learned how to raft. It's super safe. It's warm. It's deep.
So is that like the mecca of rafting if you're going to do it in Canada?
Well, in Eastern Canada, definitely. Yeah, that's the main place. And I mean, all the, I don't know if you know much about whitewater kayaking or whitewater kayaking rodeo, you know, where guys do tricks and waves and they're in these super short.
They do an Olympics, don't they? I think an event sometimes.
I don't know if playboating's been a part of the Olympics. I know the downhill racing is, but you know, the guys that are using these really short plastic boats and they're playing in waves, basically, I don't think it's become an Olympic sport yet. It may one day, but it's a mecca. I mean, the American team trains on the Ottawa. People from all over the world go there to play because, like I said, it's warm, it's deep. The wave features are unbelievable. I mean, it's a play boating mecca. It really is. Pretty fortunate to grow up there, actually.
Yeah. And you were saying that's kind of like part of the reason why Hokkaido made a little bit of sense to you, too, a little bit more of the outdoors in terms of places in Japan.
I always knew I wanted to come to Japan to train in the martial arts at some point in my life. And, you know, I just, I need to live somewhere where I can get into the wild. And Honshu, it wasn't the place for me. And I'd heard a rumor that it snowed in Hokkaido. It snowed a lot. And so, yeah, that was before really the internet was a big thing, right? It was kind of before that boom. So, I came over and I was not disappointed. It does snow here and it snows a lot.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's the reason why I chose Hokkaido. Low population, lots of outdoor pursuits. And I thought that it would be the perfect fit for me. Yeah.
And since coming here, I mean, I was going to bring it up at some point, but yeah. Our worlds kind of cross a little bit because one of the companies that I worked at quite recently was they do a lot of localization of TV programs and sell them to overseas companies, but they also help produce a lot of English programs in Japan and especially Hokkaido. So some of the programs, the outdoors programs that I worked on, I had seen you and also your partner come on as hosts and stuff. So we had never actually met before, but I kind of feel like I know a lot about you already for doing this. We were talking about it. I got drawn into suddenly doing a narration for one of the episodes of the programs that you were on and stuff. But if you don't mind me asking, like, how did that all come about of you getting involved in not just that TV program, but I guess a lot of the stuff, because you were saying that you've actually done a few different types of TV programs and stuff.
Yeah, or? Well, it all kind of started with the Wild Hokkaido stuff. So I don't know if you guys are familiar with Rob and Hades' website, Hokkaido Wilds.
No.
They have a website where they put up backcountry ski routes, they put up bike touring routes, they put up hiking routes, and so right now they're working on a sea kayaking route, maps and stuff like that. But a few years ago, they wanted to put up 50 canoe routes in Hokkaido, on their site. Mm. And so, through a mutual friend, they kind of got us, you know, they were beginners, right? They hadn't done much paddling before. So we kind of were consultants for them a little bit as to, you know, what to be careful of and what to do and where to go and where the put-in and takeouts were. And so I guess because they're quite visible with their website, NHK contacted them first and asked them if they'd be interested in doing the canoe stuff on TV. And they're pretty busy. They both work for universities. The website, I think, takes up a lot of time, and they're out there all the time as well. So they offered it to us, and they said, you know, I think you guys would do a good job with this. So that's kind of how it started. So we kind of have Hokkaido Wilds to thank for all of the NHK stuff that's happened.
Yeah. So just people that don't know, Wild Hokkaido is an NHK program. They get out all over Hokkaido. They try to show the outdoors activities that you can do here. They have families on, they have couples on, they have individuals on, and it's an English produced program that shows online and also on TV, like on Sundays and stuff, I think, on NHK. And it's just like 15-minute program. And so you've been on there a few times for different activities, right?
Yeah, well, it's been mostly canoeing. Okay. So like, we've done 8 canoeing programs, and we've done one winter program last December. We did a winter camping shoot in Songkyo, but it's been mostly the canoeing. Yeah, it's been really fun. I mean, you know, at first it's a little bit nerve-wracking, right? We're not really TV people.
You're pretty natural, though.
I will say your guys' episodes, I always thought they were kind of like the most natural and looked like kind of the most fun. Sometimes they're trying to, you know, stretch for activities and stuff, but you guys always had like a lot going on in the episodes that you guys were on and stuff.
So, oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's a nice comment.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what they wanted to do when they first contacted us, because I think they changed the way the program worked. So before COVID, it was always like a customer would come on and he'd meet a guide, and the guide would take him on a little tour,
right?
And they'd talk about the wildlife in the area and that sort of stuff. And so once COVID hit, there were no more tourists coming to Hokkaido, so they wanted to kind of change the way that the program went. So they wanted to start to highlight some of the Hokkaido locals that were doing cool stuff in Hokkaido. So, so you'll notice it's kind of the same sort of people have been coming on, you know, time and time again. So, but yeah, I mean, they just said they just be yourselves, do what you always do. So that's what we just do. They set up a bunch of cameras and we do what we always do. So
it's pretty good. So you kind of get free range in the program. It's almost like your show because you come up with the ideas as well and, yeah, take it where you want to go.
Yeah, they ask us where we should film next, I think. We don't really have any control over the narration and, you know, what they say in the program, but
unfortunately, I will say that as somebody who had to work on those scripts, we basically would get the scripts from NHK and then, but there would be a lot of rules about how stuff could be translated. A lot of it kind of makes sense because it's not necessarily for like, native English speakers. It's also for kind of like overseas countries that English exists in that country. So they're hoping like some of the people from those countries will watch the program as well. So sometimes the English is simplified. And then sometimes it's just like whoever is the producer on the program from NHK is very specific about how they want everything said and stuff. So the narration style, Ben, you've done some of the narration for that company.
Yeah.
They want it like the Japanese style, which really over the top and stuff. And that's really.
So you don't have much input into that, like what the narration is saying. You can't say, no, that's not good. I don't like that.
None.
You just do the. Yeah.
It's a surprise. You're just,
Exactly. Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
And sometimes the translation's off. Like sometimes I'll say something and I look at the translation and the translation's a little bit off. It's like, that's not quite what that meant. But, you know, whatever. I mean, people get the idea, right?
Yeah,
I mean, and it's dynamic. I mean, seeing a canoe going through whitewater, it's a very dynamic thing to watch because it's not something that's very popular, right? I mean, you're used to seeing kayaks usually go through whitewater, but to see a big Canadian canoe coming down the rapids, it's always it's fun to watch, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it's dynamic, right?
Yeah.
White water's great, man. It's
Are there any new ideas you're thinking of for the next program? Because you're doing this like what every year?
Yeah. They seem to have us back every year. So I recommended to them a couple of things. I thought because we're always trying to come up with some unique ideas. So one of them was like doing a hanami canoe trip. So during the peak. For people that don't know hanami, it's basically when the cherry blossoms are in full bloom.
Huge event in Japan.
It's huge here. So kind of coordinate, you know, the cherry blossoms with a canoe trip, maybe down the Chitose River.
Hmm.
That's a beautiful river.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah. And, you know, maybe stop along the way and have a little picnic.
Yeah.
Do the Japanese thing because, I mean, it's meant for a foreign market. So I think, you know, I really think they should try to incorporate a little more of the Japanese culture into the programs because I think it appeals to a lot of the foreign viewership, right?
Yeah.
I actually got interviewed for this probably not a canoeing one, but yeah, I mean, like Burke introduced me and he was like, in the interview, he was like, so what ideas you got? You know, and I was like, oh, is this what it is? I have to, you know, do your job? I was thinking, and I think I just like gave him some ideas, but it's all related to snowboarding.
Right.
And I think the things that I was thinking of, I was trying to think of like unique stuff, but yeah, probably a bit too dangerous maybe, which is why I think he didn't say it, but I kind of got that impression. It was like, okay, let's do some backcountry hiking. And in this particular area, which was, it was in the news recently where the Kiwi skiers, snowboarders,
the guys passed away on Yote.
In Rishiri, is that what you're talking about?
No, that was Yote.
There's been a couple of incidents recently.
Yeah,
Rishiri as well.
So that kind of just like popped into my head. Oh, what, you know, why didn't you do that? Yeah, I haven't seen that on TV before or anything. And then I kind of saw his face. I was like, yeah, he probably didn't like that one. And then didn't hear back from him after that. Yeah.
But as somebody who I guess has been out to a lot of places, not only for these TV programs, but also just maybe for your own adventures and stuff. A lot of people, when they come to Hokkaido, they kind of want to know good places to go and visit, take advantage of the outdoors that Hokkaido is known for and stuff. Mm-hmm. Do you have any, favorite places that you normally recommend or that you guys go to repeatedly and stuff? Or,
in Hokkaido?
Yeah. For whatever activity. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, part of the reason why I got involved with outdoor stuff is because my earliest memories, I always loved wildlife. I just love seeing animals in their natural environments. Part of the reason why I got involved with outdoor stuff, because I love to see the animals. So, I mean, Hokkaido is an amazing place to see some pretty rare animals in their native habitat. Mm-hmm. You know, like the Japanese cranes, for instance, around Kushiro. I mean, Mari and I go up to Kushiro probably once a year. not just to see the cranes, but to do some paddling. And the food's great up there. You can also go and see, you know, the eagles on the ice floes and Abashiri in the winter. I mean, it's the second largest eagle in the world, right? The Steller Sea Eagle.
Okay.
And you can also go and see the Blakiston's fish owl, which is the largest owl in the world.
Wow.
And there's this little pension, and they've got a blind set up that you can sit in, and they've got it lit up. They've got a river that flows past there, and they've got a little cement sort of holding pond that they put fish in, and you can watch these birds come down and feed on the fish.
This is out in Kushiro.
It's out in Rausu, actually, this one. Yeah.
So that's kind of like east.
Yeah, it's up in Shiritoko.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if somebody's interested in seeing wildlife, you know, Hokkaido's become quite a big birding destination. You know, the Shima Enaga as well, the, you know, those little birds.
Oh, just totally, yeah.
White
yeah,
birds.
Yeah.
Oh, it's called the long-tailed tit. There's lots of tits in Japan for some reason. But that's one of them.
And that's out there too. Same
yeah, there's a lot of them out there. So you can see those as well. So I don't know. I really like Doto. I like Eastern Hokkaido. You know, the paddling's not as intense. Like there's not as much white water out that way, but in terms of wildlife viewing and stuff like that, it's awesome. We try to get out there at least once a year.
Is it quite accessible without a car, or would you say you'd have to rent one if you're visiting?
Yeah, I'd rent a car if I came to do that trip. It's a long drive from here.
Yeah, the one thing is, though, you can fly from, say, like Tokyo or even Chitose, obviously, to there. They have the airport out there. Is it Kushiro? I can't remember. There's an airport out in that area.
There's a couple, eh?
Yeah, so you could probably fly out there and rent a car from there. But it's almost like that's part of the joy. It's like renting a car from here, driving through the outdoors and stuff. And that the crane area that you were mentioning, the Japanese cranes, is that Tsurui?
Yeah, Tsurimura. So we always stay in Tsurimura. There's a great hotel there. They do. I'm going to give them a plug. It's called the Green Park Hotel. And we stay there every time we go to Tsurui. Mm. And they've got the most amazing dinner ever. And, you know, I don't really like seafood that much. So Mari always asks them to do a little more heavy on the meat. And they put together, it's got to be one of the best meals I've had at any ryokan or hotel in Hokkaido. And the hot spring's nice, and you're close to the cranes, and they know we're up there doing some paddling. So every time we get a room there, there's always extra hangers for us in the closet because they know we've got to hang a bunch of stuff.
Nice. Right.
They're great. So if you ever get a chance to stay in Tsurui, I recommend the Green Park Hotel. It's not so expensive. And like I said, the food is,
Yeah. And that's like an area where a lot of photographers come. That's like right. There's certain areas where there's all these photographers set up because there's just, I don't know, hundreds or something, maybe. I don't know if there's that many, at least dozens, maybe hundreds of cranes that come to certain areas and stuff. The big,
have you been huge out there? Japanese,
yeah. Passed through for work before because I used to work in an agricultural company.
Yep.
So that's obviously a big agriculture area. So we stopped through there for promotional materials for some of the catalogs and stuff for the company. We spent the morning out there, early morning out there with all the photographers. But yeah, there's just like dozens of cranes, the really beautiful tall ones with the red somewhere on the head or something. Yeah. And stuff. Very
so
Japanese.
How long would you stay out there? Like a couple of days or more like a week? Because like you're saying, it's a long drive.
Yeah. So what we quite often what we do is I take a week off every October. During peak colors.
Yeah.
To go on a canoe trip. So it's part of my lifestyle choice. We take, usually it's the third week of October. We take the whole week off and we take off on a trip. So usually we head out that way. And because you get to see a lot of wildlife and the other thing is the drive is super beautiful in the fall, right? The colors are peaking and it's just a great time of year to be out enjoying the outdoors. Nobody's on the rivers. They're empty.
Well, that's off-peak season, right? Because everyone's working. It's that's not right. Like any summer holidays or anything. Yeah.
And so now we have to coordinate these weeks off with a wild Hokkaido shoot. kind of the good part of it is that they pay for our highway costs and our gas and our hotels. So they kind of pay for the trip a little bit. You know, we got to do a day or two of work, but we're still paddling and, you know, we're getting part of that. We're being paid for our week off, basically, right? So it's kind of a good gig. So we try to organize it so that, it happens during that week. So I think this year we're going to do an overnight on the Tokachigawa, the Tokachi River. So we'll do, you know, one day the plan is to camp on the side of the river for one night and then paddle it down to Tokachigawa Onsen. You guys familiar with that hot spring?
I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's real nice. Yeah. That's another good one. That's another place I'd recommend if you're traveling around eastern Hokkaido. Tokachigawa Onsen is, the food is great. It's right on the river. You can walk down along the river. You see cranes flying up. The cranes use the Tokachi River as a, what'd you call it, like a flying corridor.
Okay.
So you stand there for 20 minutes, a half an hour. You're going to see cranes flying by. Yeah. You're going to see white-tailed eagles. In the fall, there's salmon going up the river. I mean, it's a beautiful spot. And the hot springs that, what they call moru? Moru you? It's that brown.
Oh, yeah.
Like that silky kind of water. Mahdi loves that water. It's that really good for your skin.
Yeah.
That's a great hot spring. Mm. Great location. It's another.
How far is that away from Sapporo by car?
If you take the highway, it would be about two and a half hours at the most.
Yeah,
if
you're not on
the
too highway, bad.
It's not so bad. Yeah.
Might head out that way. Yeah, because my wife loves onsens, but she doesn't really like nature so much. she
despite
likes
living in Hokkaido.
Yeah, she likes the onsens in nature, but she actually doesn't like to venture outside too much because they're like bugs and doesn't like the cold. Yeah, it's kind of surprising.
I highly recommend that one. Yeah, it's a great hot spring. Another really good one's in Nakashibetsu. Do you know? Have you ever heard of Daiichi Hotel?
Daiichi Hotel, yeah.
Are they like a chain, a group of hotels?
I don't know, but I, for some reason, like commercials, I just remember hearing the name, like Daiichi.
Yeah.
I gotta say, they've got the nicest outdoor baths I've seen in Hokkaido.
Hmm.
And you're gonna pay to stay there. It's not cheap.
What makes a good outdoor bath?
Well, it's set right along the river, and they've got like several different kinds of baths. And set between the men's and the women's bath right down by the river is a mixed bath, which isn't very popular in Hokkaido, right?
Yeah.
So you can enter it from the men's side and from the women's side. So you can go and you can sit with your partner in the mixed bath right in front of the river. And kind of the thing that makes this place special is they also feed the Blakiston's fish owls. So you can actually hear them when you're sitting in the hot spring. They've got this real deep, like it just reverberates. It's incredible, man. Mm. And so inside there's a viewing area and the birds will come right down. You can, they're right there. It's pretty cool, man.
So I mean, what's the name of the onsen?
It's called Daiichi Hotel.
Maybe,
Yuyado Daiichi, I think is the name of it. I'll plug them too. I think it's a great hotel. The food's great. The service is top notch. You get to see the owls. It's another great.
We gotta back up a little bit and ask a question that I know Ben wants to ask. You said mixed onsen. Is there attire or no attire or
no attire?
So everyone in there is just kind of there with the understanding that there may be people of the opposite sex also in there.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Yes.
And it's okay. No issues. No like complaints.
There weren't any issues when we were there. And we didn't go during the during high noon. we were in there in the evening, but yeah, it's nice to be able, because Mahdi and I go to a lot of hot springs. So we get it's part of our thing, right? We go somewhere, we paddle, and
we love hot springs too.
It's such a great part of being here, and they're everywhere, right? So, but the problem is, you always have to be separated, right?
Yeah.
So it's one of the few places, one of the good few places where you can actually enjoy it together. So it's top on my list.
So where is this one? What's
it's in Nakashibetsu.
Nakashibetsu.
So there's actually an airport in Nakashibetsu well. You can fly to Nakashibetsu and from there you could rent a car. You could hit Shiretoku's not far from there. Daiichi Hotel's not far from there. It's a pretty sweet spot.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, how can I get my wife out there? Because she doesn't like to drive long distances either. So flying, I guess, to the airport would be a compromise. I think she would love that onsen too, just hearing about the shared mixed bath. I don't think I've ever heard of one before in Hokkaido. Might be one of the only ones.
There's one. I know that Grand Hotel in Niseko they have a mixed bath there too. Years ago, I went only once, but I don't know if it's still there, but I know Grand Hotel is kind of famous for having a mixed bath. It's down near Moiwa. So if you go past Moiwa, when you go down the hill, on the left-hand side is where Grand Hotel is. But
do you still go to Niseko? Because, you know, these days it's changed a lot, right, with the crowds and the
I stopped
hotels.
Going to Niseko 10 years ago.
Me too.
Because it was too busy. It was too busy 10 years ago. Now it's ridiculous. I have no use for that place anymore. It's terrible to say that. It's just, it's gotten out of hand.
No, I have a lot of friends that come, not a lot, but some friends that come over both from Asia and from North America. And then, you know, they all go to Niseko and they're all like, oh, come meet us, come meet us. And I'm like, oh, maybe I'll come have lunch out there. They don't want to get on the mountain too much, you know, so.
And you went this winter as
Yeah, just a few weeks ago. That was the situation, basically. And so we went and had lunch, and then I ended up driving them around. I drove them over to Noboribetsu and Lake Toya and kind of gave them like an afternoon tour instead of going on the mountain out there because, just too many people and stuff. So.
Have you guys seen that viral video of the Hirafu gondola lift line?
No.
I've seen maybe one similar. Yeah.
Was that this season?
Yeah. I'll show you after. It's ridiculous. I refuse to be a part of that mayhem. Yeah.
So what was it? It was just like so long and people waiting
just
for a long time.
Ridiculous. Yeah. Just endless.
Oh, man.
It's too bad because, you know, part of what made, in my opinion, I mean, there's many things that make skiing and snowboarding in Hokkaido special. And part of it was the lack of people, you know, and that's gone now. And so it's completely changed the vibe and the feeling of the place, right? I mean, I'm not against tourism, but, you know, when it becomes too much, it kind of loses that special feeling, right? Now, there are some places in Hokkaido that
which
still
we don't
have.
We don't mention those places.
Keep those people away. As long as possible, right?
But even those places are
starting to get busier, man. Well, I've noticed out. It. Yeah, it's not a secret anymore, that's for sure.
Well, that's the thing with skiers, snowboarders. We're all looking for the same thing, right? We're looking to get away from people. We're looking for that powder. So it's just finding the quieter places now. Which is, it's a shame because, you end up having to kind of like look for new places eventually. But so far, since I've been here, we've been very lucky. You know, I've been here 15 years, but it's, you can feel the change.
And we're locals. We know the hill way better than these tourists do. And we can stay ahead of them. Yeah. So I still get my fair share. That's for sure. I can't really complain.
Well, I think maybe we met skiing on the mountain.
Yeah.
But every time I see you, you don't hang around. You're like, okay, I'm off. You know, get off the lift. If it's a powder day, I mean, I get it too. It's like, I'm not, I don't want people to like follow me and everything. So you're with your group, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm the same when I go to my local mountain as well. As soon as I see like a group, I try to get ahead of them or go separate ways.
It's become more of a, it's definitely changed. You know, when I first started skiing at my local place, Marty and I were the only ones up there. Like we rode by ourselves for years. We know, like there was just no foreigners there at all and barely anybody hitting the powder, right?
Was this like 20 years ago, 15 years ago?
15, 16. Like I probably started riding seriously in Hokkaido around 2009-ish, 2008-ish. Oh, it was probably before that. Yeah, 2007-2008-ish is when I started riding seriously here and, you know, bought a car and
season pass
and going for it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, in those days, I mean, there was nobody there. Absolutely nobody there. It was crazy. I'm almost nobody in the powder. Like it would snow and you could, if it didn't snow for 3 days, it wouldn't matter. There was so much left over. People just didn't ride the trees. That's changed.
Yeah. Well, I wonder what happened there. Like why just people heard about it and then word got around. Oh, actually it's not so dangerous. You know, you can go into the trees. It's fine kind of thing.
I think a couple of things have happened. I think the gear has improved, right? So like with the advent of fatter skis and better gear, lighter stuff, I think it's just
powder boards as well.
That's right. With the snowboarding as well. So it just made it more accessible to people that maybe are mediocre riders. You know, in the old days when you're on skinny skis, you had to be a good skier to be able to ski powder.
Yeah.
Right? But now you don't have to be a good skier to ski powder as long as you got a pair of fat boards
on. The technology's that good.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It does it for you almost.
I heard the same with powder boards as well, because I've never ridden one. But yeah, a friend recently bought one and he said it just going through the trees is so easy now. Yeah. Like he doesn't get tired on the legs, you know? And I didn't kind of believe it at first, and he said the same thing when he heard that. He's like, nah, I can't really make much of a difference. Yeah. But he said, yeah, now just he can ride fast and feel safe, comfortable, and he's not that confident in snowboarding as well, but right. Now that board has like leveled him up like two levels or something.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah, I think the advent of the new technology has changed the game. It's a different sport. Right? I mean,
slalom.
Well, it's just like, you know, regular skiing on piste is it's very different than skiing powder.
Yeah.
Right? They're two different. They're almost like two different sports.
Mm.
I love it. I just.
Yeah. I mean, how many days did you get this season?
Well, I'm a little bit behind schedule this year. I'm at about 42 days.
Oh, wow. Jesus. I've actually been zero this year. So, yeah.
Wow.
Usually I'm sitting around 50, 55 this time of year.
This one's been it's been a strange season.
It's been a weird one.
Yeah. Coming late, I felt in the beginning, there wasn't too much snow.
Yeah.
But March was surprisingly good.
Best March probably in a decade,
yeah,
I would say. And that's been the redemption for what we had to put up with this winter.
Yeah.
Is having a great end of season. And that's what I hope for now, man. I just pray every year that we have big Decembers and big Marches.
Yeah, that's perfect.
It's kind of the least locals, bit, yeah, off the peak season.
Right,
too.
And so December, we didn't get it this year, but we certainly got in March. So pretty stoked on that. Yeah. It's been great.
So so you also run your own English school.
Yes, that's right.
So that kind of allows you the freedom to ski as much as you do and take those weeks off in October.
Yes, I worked for, when I first got here, I worked for a pretty famous Eikaiwa. And it was a good gig for the first 5 or 6 years. They would, you know, set your schedule up for you. So if I wanted certain evenings off, they'd accommodate that. They paid well. It was a great place to work. And then they were bought out by a bigger company and things just went right down the toilet, basically. So I was kind of forced to make a change. And so I decided to work until the beginning of December. I bought a pass at a local ski area.
Well done.
I almost said it.
Yeah.
And then, and I just skied all winter and just slowly started to fill in, you know, areas where I wanted to work and keeping areas where I don't want to work free. And just over the years, it's just kind of, it's like a puzzle, basically. You just fill in the spaces where you want to work. And then, like I said, you leave areas where you don't want to work open. And so I do 38 lessons a year with the kids. So it allows for quite a bit of time off. Mm. I take, basically my schedule is the same as an elementary school kid's schedule. I get the summers off. I get the winter holiday off. Today's the first day of my spring holiday.
Oh, nice.
I got 2 weeks off. I take a week off in October and I take a week off during high water in the spring. So that's kind of how my schedule works out. And I teach mostly kids and group kids lessons. And so when the kids lessons are done, I teach adults in the evenings. So I try to keep my mornings free because I want to go skiing. So yeah, it's basically how it's worked out, and it's worked out really well. I've been doing it for about 12 years and that's been really good. Yeah.
I'm kind of curious because I've been away from teaching for a while, but I'm always curious, like, especially for people who have their own schools, how do you like recruit or get new students? Is it all word of mouth, or is just you've got a place that's known well enough now that people are kind of looking to come to you, contact you first? Or
so I was given a mum and tots class from a girl I used to work with. She went back to New Zealand and she gave me this it's called Little E. And it's a small mum and tots class. So kids before they go into kindergarten. So kids from, basically 6 months to 3 years old and their mums. And I teach that class every Thursday morning. And so the kids usually stay in the class until they go into the first year of kindergarten. And so once they go into that first year of kindergarten, a lot of the moms want them to continue taking English with me. So I'll form a Nensho, a first year kindergarten class. And so, generally speaking, I have that class until the kids are in grade six.
Mm.
So, you know, you have the kids for quite a long time. As a matter of fact, I've got a girl right now who I'm teaching privately. She's in grade six. She started in that class when she was 1.5 years old.
Wow.
So I've been teaching her for, what would that be? 6, 7, 9, 10, about 11 years I've been teaching this girl. And her English is great. She's super Genki, loves English, tries hard. She's just a great kid.
Yeah. Huh.
And to see her growing up, it's a real pleasure, you know?
So the students, like most of your students start from that class and they
a lot of them do grow up and they just grow up. And then from there, it's word of mouth. A lot of it, right? I don't really advertise too much. I've got posters up at the Kai Cons that I teach at. I've got an Instagram page for the little E class, but I don't really put a whole lot of money into advertisement. It's been mostly word of mouth. Now COVID really kicked me in the butt. Because now the mums aren't seeing the other mums anymore.
Mm,
right. So that word of mouth completely disappeared for me.
Mm.
And it's coming back now, but it was a couple of hard years there to try to keep numbers up. That's for sure.
Yeah. Cause I know like around this time of the year, I guess February, March is like recruitment time for students. But like you're saying, you don't really do that. You just kind of rely on word of mouth.
Yeah. So this year, because COVID kind of hit me hard, I don't have a whole lot of kids going into first year kindergarten. So I've got two that are going in the first year kindergarten. So I'm just going to move those kids into my second year kindergarten class. I mean, they're all kindergarten kids, right?
Mm.
So, but you know, if the numbers start to grow, I'll just form another class and move the first years into the first year class and leave the second year class the way it is. But generally speaking, like for the last 10 years, I've created a new class every year, pretty much.
Oh, nice. Mm. So you're growing.
Yeah, it is growing. Yeah. It's doing okay. I mean, I'm not a big, I don't have anybody. It's a one man show basically, right? I do everything, but
there's quite a few, people I know that in similar position as you, is like that. They have their own Aikawa. They're kind of the one teacher.
Yeah.
And they do their own recruitment. They usually have their partner or wife doing that the admin stuff, dealing with the mums. Do you have plans to, I don't know, get even bigger, hire new teachers, become like the next big Aikawa or something like that?
I don't know if it's going to take time away from everything else.
Eventually, I mean, I'm going to get to the point where I'm not going to be one. I'm not going to, you know, I'm 51 now, so I mean, I don't know how much longer I can keep teaching kids so eventually the plan is to have a teacher come in and do the teaching for me, and I'll kind of do all the other work behind, you know, closed doors. So
there's a lot of energy involved with teaching kids that young, I guess.
You've got to be energetic with little kids.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm lucky. I'm blessed with a lot of energy.
You have a lot of energy.
So I guess I'm kind of made for teaching kids.
Yeah, I can do it.
A lot of people say that.
Yeah, that's a lot of people.
I did elementary school for 2 years and I got burnt out.
Yeah.
It was intense. And that was like in my, kind of mid-30s. So I'm 40 now, and I can't see myself going back to that.
I think a lot of people think, like, oh, kids will be fun, but they don't realize it means like year round.
Yeah,
with kids,
it's got to be on all the time.
Oh yeah, you got. There's no downtime when you've got a group of 4-year-olds looking up at you. Right? It's 10 of them. You know what I mean? It's full on, man. But you know, there's pros and cons to everything in life, right? So like with the kids, the pro for me is that I do not hear the clock going tick. Tick, tick, tick. 1 hour is done. Like it feels like 3 minutes, right? When you're dealing with the little kids. And I get so much love from these kids, right? They're so stoked to see me every week. And I feed off of that too.
Yeah, you get their energy as well.
The energy, right? Yeah. It's like a concert, kind of, right? Like the kids are super energetic. It energizes me and that energizes them. And it's, you know, it's like a, you know, I'm sure you've been to concerts where the crowd's been lame. You know, it's not fun for the guys on stage, right? That's kind of similar, I think. I mean, I'd much rather spend my days with a bunch of kids than dealing with a bunch of complicated adults, to be perfectly honest with you, or watching the clock.
Yeah. We're only halfway through.
Yeah, that was kind of like Eikaiwa, you know, when you're teaching adults, right? Yeah, like looking at the clock.
I don't know. It's different doing your own thing too. It's my own thing. So you take pride in running your own show. And I'm lucky. The kids are awesome. I don't have any bad apples in the bunch. And because you can filter those out. You know, where a regular Eikaiwa, if there's a bad apple, they won't get rid of it. It affects the bottom line. But if there's a bad apple for me, I'm not afraid to say, okay, I don't need this in my class, right? I mean, so yeah, my classes are great. The kids are great. I have fun with it. And I get a lot of time off. So I do have time to re-energize, right? So
it sounds like you have everything you wanted the way you want it. Like almost like you've sussed out life in a way.
It's been well planned. It's taken a while to get here though. I mean, in terms of, you know, planning the work and, you know, there's ups and downs with it too, right? There's times where you're not making as much money and there's times where it's really good. So you kind of take the good with the bad and it averages out over time. But, you know, I want to be able to make sure that I can get out and enjoy myself. If I can't get out and ski as much as I ski or be in the dojo a couple of nights a week, I mean, what am I doing really? I mean, life's not about work.
Sitting in front of a computer screen the whole day.
Right? I mean, I want to have more life in my life than work.
Yeah. Life balance.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
life balance. I mean, was that the plan when you came over, was to stay long-term or just short-term and it ended up being this long? Or?
No, it wasn't actually. I planned on coming over for 1 year.
Yeah.
But 1 year is not enough.
No.
It was like, I felt like I only scratched the surface after a year. And I was like, well, what am I going to do to stay here longer? And so, I got the working. Actually, I started because I was only working part-time at that Eikaiwa. At the time. So, they wouldn't sponsor me.
Oh, really?
Cause you have to be full time. I didn't want to be full time. So I actually got on what's called the Bunka Katsudo visa, which is a, cultural activities visa.
Oh, because of the martial arts.
Because of the martial arts.
Wow.
And as a matter of fact, that's kind of that was the path I took to get my permanent residence here. I wasn't married. I didn't have a full time job. It didn't look like I made a whole lot of money on paper. I wasn't a very good candidate in terms of somebody getting permanent residence. So I kind of went the martial art way, and my sensei put together like this real nice booklet and letter of recommendation. Mahdi tied it all in together with my letter of the reason why I wanted it. And actually, I had a guy actually call me and question me about my finances and stuff like that. All in Japanese. I felt like I did a pretty poor job. But we went off on a canoe trip. And when we got back, the card was in the mail and they'd actually given it to me. Wow. So I was super stoked.
How long did that take? So you on this cultural visa for how many years?
I was on the cultural visa for about 3 years. And so technically with a cultural visa, you're not allowed to work. So you can get a separate permit. Forget what it's called, but it's got a long name.
Yeah, when I was a student, I think that was the same thing.
Yes,
yeah.
They do it for students and other types of visas to allow you to work up to 20 hours. So I was working 20 hours a week, but the wage was pretty good. So when I handed in my cultural activities visa application, the guy's like, you're making way too much money. He's like, this is for people working at 7-Eleven. You know, it's not for you. Right? You need to change your visa. So I actually ended up, I started working full time at the school I was at after that, and they ended up sponsoring me. So I did that for a while, and then I didn't want to work for the Eikaiwas anymore. I was tired of it. So I thought the only way I can do it is to get a permanent visa here. And it worked out. Yeah. Yeah.
So this cultural visa, like you can only work 20 hours, you were saying. And is it like you're teaching about Japanese culture, or is it learning about it?
So I was learning about Japanese culture. So if you're here learning tea ceremony or sumo or a martial art or whatever it is, something to do with Japanese culture, you can get a cultural activities visa.
And that's the one you came over on?
No, I came over on a working holiday visa.
Oh, really? Oh, wow.
It's kind of a funny story because I went into I'd realized that my body wasn't able to keep up with all of the rafting and paddling and skiing and martial arts and all the stuff I was doing. It was too hard being a blue collar athlete, right? I needed to change something. So I thought, okay, if I always wanted to go to Japan, it's my last year that I can actually get a working holiday visa. You can get it. You can apply up till the age of 30.
Okay.
So I applied for it 2 weeks before my 31st birthday. And I went to the Japanese embassy in Ottawa. And it's on the corner of Briere Street, which is my last name. So I parked on Briere Street and walked over to the Japanese embassy 2 weeks before my 31st birthday, and they gave it to me. So I came over on a working holiday visa.
Wow.
Oh, there's a lot of signs that it was meant to be.
Yeah. That's pretty cool seeing. Yeah. I've never driven on Briere Street, so that's pretty stoked to see that.
What are your long-term goals? Do you plan to stay here forever, retire here, or end up selling your school and going back to Canada or something?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I'd like eventually, you know, I mean, I've been training in these classical martial arts for 20 years now. So I'm planning to be here until I'm at least about 62, figure another 10, 12 years. And then I'd like to spend part of my year back in North America, maybe conducting classical Japanese martial arts seminars. There's not a whole lot of people. I've done 30 years in Japan, you know, constantly training. I think I've got something that I can offer that community. So I'd like to do that maybe in the off season, go over to Canada, North America, and travel around and maybe teach seminars and spend my winters here.
Yeah, it sounds like you kind of got the setup where it might be possible to do that.
I might be able to pull it off. We'll see. I mean, it's kind of a long-term thing. We'll see kind of how my health does and, you know, but I love the Japanese martial arts. So I'd like to be able to, it's something you could do, you know, well into your later years in life. I mean, my sensei is 76.
Oh, wow.
And that dude, man, he's a modern day samurai. I mean, he, unbelievable how good he is. I mean, he's forgotten more than I'll ever absorb.
Right.
Another guy's 80, still moving like a man 20 years younger, you know, like, yeah, it's good. It's not as hard on your body.
Yeah. Well, for us, I think for me and you, Burke, we do, you know, jiu-jitsu. Yeah. I don't know if we could keep doing it into our 70s.
There are guys that are that old doing it, but it's definitely not as forgiving, I would say, maybe some of the other martial arts. So
we've got a couple oldish guys at our gym in their 60s. His body's not too great. You know, he doesn't feel as strong as when he used to be, but there's one guy that's still really strong. He's like, nearly 60.
Yeah.
He's still doing competitions and stuff, like hard as a rock on his fucking be like
that.
Is
there a seniors class around Sapporo or something?
Yeah, that's what we need.
That's the thing. Like, if you're training that age, you kind of need the understanding of the people you're training with and stuff.
So like, I don't have anybody trying to choke me out.
I mean, most people are pretty understanding, but every now and then you just got somebody going in there and wants to get aggressive. And if they're not, so you got to pick your partners wisely, I think.
Yeah, train smarter when you get to around 40, I found, you know,
I think with any martial art too, is guys that have more experience are always better to roll with or to spar with. You know, they've got more control. It's sometimes the novice to intermediate stage, which is kind of the scary guys. They have no control. You don't realize what you could potentially do to somebody,
exactly,
right? I'm sure it's the same with BJJ.
100%.
Because they want to do like competitions and they want to impress people and they want to, you know, like, let's go for the higher belt. So, like, try to prove a point, and then that's when, you know, injuries happen and stuff like that. Egos get in the way.
That's right. There's a certain amount of machoism that's still present in some dojos.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that machoism gets chased out of the dojo pretty quick in Canada.
Yeah.
I noticed. Like, anybody that came in there that was a fighter and wanted to use it, you know, in the street or whatever, they got taught a lesson in the dojo and they never came back.
Yeah.
Right? But I don't know. It's one of those things. I mean, it's a hard one.
Well, I think we're about that time.
Okay.
Yeah. Greg, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, man. It's
been really
awesome
interesting.
Talk, man.
Yeah. Our mutual friend was talking about, you know, getting you on. So, you should get Greg on and Right, yeah, for about a year, he's been like,
"Oh, really?" Yeah, yeah. I was wondering about that. I was wondering how did this come about?
Yeah, when he suggested, I was like, "The guy from TV. Yeah, we should definitely."
Yeah, he's got so many interesting stories, and it was just trying to figure out a time when we could all get together.
Right,
because you're enjoying your life so much. So
thank you, much appreciated. Yeah, it's been great.
Thanks for taking the time to come on.
Thank you.
And thanks for joining us, everyone. Hope you enjoyed that. We'll catch you next time.
Bye bye.